Thank you for coming today. My name is Justin Higgins. Some of you came yesterday to chat about Locus. I am, for those of you who don't know me, I'm trained as a neuroscientist, spent many years studying mostly birds, bird brains, did some work studying human sound localization, spent some time studying mice and their visual system. And the approach that I took in a lot of my academic work was very much grounded in animal behavior and really trying to understand animals and how their brains work, anchored in their behavior and what works to help them to navigate the world around them. And so through this work, I learned a lot about various animals. And so I'm excited to be able to share with you all today a little bit about monarchs and the monarch's compass. So to get started, I think most folks in North America are familiar with monarch butterflies. Monarch butterflies are one of the great migrators of North America. So they every year they go through a massive seasonal migration, largely from wintering grounds in Mexico, and in the spring they travel up throughout North America, particularly up through the Midwest. There's also large populations that winter along the California coast. And then in summer, they can be found throughout North America. And then in the fall, they migrate back south. The Xerxes Society apparently doesn't know very much about monarchs in Mexico, which is a shame. But we do know a lot about kind of where their main grounds are, where they're found throughout the year. And so when we think about monarchs, when we think about the ecology of monarchs and what supports monarchs, what comes to mind?
Milkweed.
Yeah. And so what is milkweed, and why is milkweed important to monarchs?
It's their only food source, right?
Yeah, it's their primary food source. And importantly, the milkweed plants are also where they lay their eggs. And this is really important for them to be able to lay the eggs, for the little baby caterpillars to grow, and then to come into adulthood. And so when we think about when we look at this monarch journey, this migration happens over many, many generations. So an individual monarch doesn't live for the full year; they live for several months. And so any given monarch is only going to make part of this journey. So the monarch's going to make part of this journey. They're going to, they might start, be born down in Mexico, might start making their journey north. Their northward journey is effectively following the milkweed. So as spring is coming, and as spring turns into summer, the area where milkweed is starting to blossom, it blossoms first further south in the warmer climates. And then as spring moves along, so early on you start having milkweed. Oh, I'm sorry. It was working yesterday.
Or point with your finger. It's just hard to see.
Yeah. So in the springtime, in the early time of the early part of spring, milkweed's going to be blossoming kind of throughout the south in the warmer climates. As the weeks and months go by, the milkweed kind of makes its way further and further north. And that spring migration of the monarch butterflies is basically following that milkweed. It's basically following the milkweed north as more milkweed comes to blossom into flower. And then as they hit the end of summer, the milkweed starts to die off, they start losing their food source, and they need to migrate back south. But you are this monarch butterfly who was born in the upper Midwest, your milkweed has run out, and you gotta go somewhere. And so how do they know A, to go south, and B, how do they know which way south is? A is, I mean, the short answer is something in their genetics, you know, that they know that if they don't have enough milkweed, then they need to start heading south. The second question, though, is more going to be what the topic of our conversation is today. How do they figure out which way is south? And that's what it says wrong this time. So let's think about this a little bit. So you're a little monarch butterfly. What cues do you have in your environment around you to try to figure out which way is south? Which way do you need to fly?
The sun
is a major cue. So especially we're talking like summertime, late fall. Where's the sun going to be in the sky? It's going to tend to be in the south. Yeah, that might change though based on the time of day, right? Morning time it's going to be coming up in the east, evening setting in the west. What if they can't see the sun? What if the actual sun is occluded? Maybe there's a huge mountain, or maybe there's clouds.
Temperature.
Might be a temperature gradient. They might be able to just gravitate towards something warmer.
Do plants turn towards the sun to orient them at all?
Oh, that's a good question. But yeah, no, there might be other cues in the environment though that help to orient south. Thinking about other things.
At all?
What's that?
Could they be sensitive to like magnets?
There could be possibly a magnetic cue. Yeah, that's another cue for which way is south is the magnetic poles. They could have a magnetic sense. Your sense?
Oh, so does polarized light go through clouds?
Maybe? Yeah, so polarized light is a really interesting phenomenon that gives additional information. So when we think about the sun, often you can step outside, and even if you can't see the sun, there's a lot of indicators that you, even as a human, have about which direction the sun is. The sky is darker further away from the sun, right? There are clouds, or there are shadows that we rely on a lot to figure out which way the sun is. But there's also another cue in the sky that is incredibly useful. So what this picture is showing on the left, so it's a picture of effectively the same sky. On the left is a photograph that was taken with just a kind of standard camera. On the right is a photograph that was taken with a polarization filter on it. So photographers who have taken photos outside with polarization filters are familiar with this phenomenon, but when you use a polarized light filter in the sky, what you end up with in your photos is a gradient from a very dark portion of the sky to a very bright portion of the sky. And how that gradient orients depends on the orientation of your polarization filter. So there's this thing called polarized light that ends up being this additional cue. So we jump back. So what exactly does this mean? Sorry, I cannot find. I don't understand why this computer stuff is not working the way it's supposed to. Okay. So what exactly is polarized light? So I'm going to come over here to this board over here. So light is. Can be considered to be a wave or a particle, depending on the details of and these like experiments that physicists did with little slits and trying to get as little light through as possible. But very often, and we can consider light to be a wave, so it's an electromagnetic wave. One of the interesting things about this wave is that the wave does have a certain amount of directionality. So the light wave moves as the light beam is traveling. And this wave, if you've got a light beam that's going in a particular direction, particularly if it's coming from the sun, which is just a massive light source, that wave is going to be going kind of up and down. There's other waves that are kind of going back and forth. There's other waves that are kind of going diagonal. So if you think about a beam of light that's traveling towards you from the sun, that beam of light is going to be having a bunch of these waves. There's even circular waves. If you like imagine like a jump rope and like spinning a jump rope and that kind of like corkscrew style wave. And each of these types of waves can be filtered out. So by having the way that a polarized light filter works for photography is that it's a filter with a bunch of tiny vertical slits that make it so that the waves that are going sideways can't pass through the slits, but only the waves that are going vertical can pass through the slits. This is very useful if you're out on a boat and you don't want to get the glare of reflection off of the water, because when that light bounces off the water and comes up to hit your eyes, that the waves that have reflected, because they've bounced off the water, they end up being polarized horizontally. And so if you're wearing sunglasses with a polarization filter on it, it can cut out that glare from the water, but still let you see all the other light around. The same thing happens in the sky. So as we have this unpolarized sunlight that's coming barreling through space and hits our atmosphere causes some of that light to bounce away, causes some of that light to deflect down to us, some of the light goes straight through. But the light that gets bounced off of these molecules in the atmosphere and comes down to us ends up being polarized, and it's polarized horizontally. So when we imagine all the cues that are around us in the sky, we end up, each of these diagrams is showing kind of polar coordinates, so north, south, east, and west. And if you imagine, you know, an observer, you or a butterfly that's sitting right here in the middle, you have different cues that are coming from different directions. So as we talked about, the actual, you know, celestial bodies, you know, the sun itself becomes an important cue, and where exactly it is varies through the day. The sun, though, in the top middle there, also exerts this polarization pattern. So no matter where you are, you end up with these kind of concentric circles in the sky around the sun as the sun's light bounces off the atmosphere and then comes down to where you are. So what this means, though, is that no matter where the sun is in the sky, if you look straight up, and if you can identify what the direction of polarization is, then you know that that is perpendicular to the direction of the sun, that it makes a T with the direction of the sun. We also then have, as I was talking about, an overall just intensity gradient of the sky. Around the sun, the sky is brighter, there's more light that's reflecting through the atmosphere to come towards you. And as you go to the sky that's farthest away from the sun, it's darker. We also talked about the Earth's magnetic field, which is a cue. At nighttime, we might have the Milky Way. So the Milky Way ends up being an incredibly reliable cue of what direction north and south and east and west is. And it's a cue that navigators have been in the ocean navigators have used for centuries. One more cue that we didn't talk about is also a chromatic gradient. So we've talked about kind of this gradient of intensity of light, the way that the sky filters light as well. There's a shift as you go. Based on the relative to the solar median of your elevation, a shift from slightly more green light to slightly more purple light. So Let's see. Okay. So in general, there's a lot of things that the bugs can use. So let's think about our monarchs and what they might be using. There's one thing though that we haven't accounted for in this discussion. So we've got a bunch of different cues in the sky. A bunch of these cues are reliant on the sun. If it's not the sun itself, it's sort of something that is an effect of the sun, right? The gradient in the sky is a secondary effect of the sun. The polarization pattern is a secondary effect of the sun. What makes this possibly not super reliable for knowing which way is south?
Night.
What's that?
The night.
The night? What about even just morning and afternoon? Right, so even from morning to afternoon, if you don't know whether it's 10 a.m. or 2 p.m., it's going to be really hard to judge which way is south, right? Because at 10 a.m., south is going to be a little bit to the right of the sun. At 2 p.m., south is going to be a little bit to the left of the sun. So this is another challenge that our monarchs are going to need to contend with.
Do they have a magnetic compass, sort of?
They could have a magnetic compass. Monarchs don't, though. They don't appear to, at least. So there are some birds that seem to have there are many birds that have a magnetic sense. It's still an open debate about where exactly those magnetic receptors are and like how they actually sense those magnetic fields. We can chat about that in a little bit because it's an interesting story. But the monarchs are actually able to rely almost exclusively on the light, not sunlight, to be able to make this, to the best of our. And I've got some cool videos in a minute. Yeah.
So what about the different wavelengths of light? Like, so can they see like infrared or ultraviolet? Is that the
that's a good
gradient that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's part of this gradient. And I think that is. I don't remember exactly what the wavelength is of the violet light in this in the chromatic gradient, but that might be pushing a little bit higher up into the UV band. That's very possible. So. Okay. So basically, as we think about then this combination of polarized light as well as as we think about polarized light, the primary kind of polarization band then kind of does a pivot in the sky as the sun rises and kind of passes through the south sky and then sets. So early on. In the morning, the polarization band, the polarized light, will be a little bit more on the north-south gradient. As we shift toward noon, then the polarization band kind of goes east-west. As we shift toward the afternoon, then the polarization band switches back to kind of the north-south gradient. And so, there's basically kind of three kind of big things that our monarchs are able to. Need to be able to attend to, and they're kind of major cues for them. And for them, the key things are, where's the bright thing in the sky? Like, can I see the sun? You know, and where's the bright thing? How does the color of the sky change? How does the polarization of the sky change? What direction is this polarized light pointing? And finally, what time of day is it? And we're going to... The kind of key, interesting parts of the monarch eye are built to try to answer and to bring in exactly these cues. So here's a zoom in on a monarch butterfly's face. They're lovely creatures. Their main retina is very large. Their main retina primarily brings up vision. It's their main source of vision. What you would think of as kind of gathering the light around them. On the very top edge of their eye is a specialized structure. It's called the dorsal rim. And this portion of their eye collects polarized light. That's its entire function, is to sense polarized light. A number of other creatures have this. The locusts that we were talking about yesterday have this dorsal rim as well. And so this cue, combined with some of these spectral cues, provide kind of all the information that the monarch needs in order to judge this skylight gradient. So their main eye picks up these like green purple color band and is able to see that chromatic gradient through the sky. And then that dorsal rim is able to pick up the polarization direction. And so these two main things help them to be able to identify which way is south. And part of what this means is that those cues are sufficient that can be replicated even in the laboratory. So in the laboratory, by positioning a monarch with a polarization filter up above and then like a green LED elsewhere, then scientists are able to construct experiments in order to judge how they're actually using these cues in order to navigate.
And do they always follow the green light?
Yes and no. I don't remember exactly like what the precedence is between the two cues, or if they come in conflict, like how the monarchs reconcile those. But we do know is that this does has let researchers at least dive deeper into like which structures are sensitive to which of the features. Because you can do things like put a little bit of like paint or cover up the dorsal rim and show that they're not able to sense the polarizer, but they're still able to sense the UV, or sorry, the green light. So what does this actually look like, and how can we be confident that they're able to use the polarized light? So this is a field study, and what we have here, we basically have like a little bucket cone thing that's open on the top. A monarch has been wild caught and kind of affixed to a little thing that it can pivot and fly around, and where the video is coming from below. And above that, the researchers have put a polarizing filter that's parallel to the skylight. Here we go. And so that, this monarch is flying in a particular direction that's consistent with the polarized filter. When the polarized filter shifts, now the monarch shifts consistent with the polarized filter. So this monarch doesn't have any cues around it. All it's got is the polarizing cues coming from above. So by shifting the polarized filter, the monarch then shifts the direction that it's trying to fly.
But the time is the same.
What's that?
Is the time of day the same?
Yeah. This is like within a few minutes of each other. Yeah, maybe we can look exactly. What is this? Like 2:30 in the afternoon?
Right.
2:27? Yeah, we're talking within a few minutes. Yeah. And then, if we... So then if they put in a UV interference filter in place that blocks basically the polarized light from coming through, then the monarch has no particular sense of direction of where to fly. It's just completely lost its sense of directionality. And then they are able to remove that filter, and it goes right back to flying the way that one would expect it to. So the kind of these key cues is that from the sunlight, we have light Polarized light comes down into the dorsal rim, and this ends up being the structure that's responsible for polarized light. Different colors of light then, including UV, can be picked up in the main retina, and that becomes kind of the main cue for bringing in skylight. Then we're dealing with this time of day question. And it turns out that many creatures can sense time of day. We've talked about, I'm sure that you've heard of like circadian clocks, right? This is where jet lag comes from. And so, we have this entrainment of a circadian clock. For us, it's largely through vision. For monarchs, it turns out that their clocks are entrained through their antennae. So the antennae are primarily olfactory sensors, so that it's primarily smell and picking up chemicals in the environment. But for some reason, their antennae also are light sensitive, and their antennae appear to establish their circadian rhythm. And so they've got all these cues. They've got this like time of day clock that helps to calibrate this compass and shift like where south is relative to these other cues. They've got to merge in and pull together the polarization cues and the light cues. If they're inconsistent with each other, they're going to need to reconcile them. And all of this happens in their brain, and it happens in an area that's called the central complex. So how do we know, what's going on in their brain? Well, it turns out that monarchs aren't the only insect that does this kind of behavior. So we actually have a bunch of different insects that do various orienting behavior based on vision, depending on their needs. So we've been talking about the monarch up in the top middle, which is kind of this long distance migrator. There are dung beetles that gather up dung and need to get out of the dung pile. We'll talk about them in a second. That they need to be able to navigate very quickly. We've got bees that have to be able to get back home after their outbound trip. We've got ants that are out foraging and need to find their way back. And it turns out that all these creatures actually have very similar visual systems for managing this information, even though they're relying on different cues in the environment. And so if we look at the brains of a bunch of these bugs that are trying to navigate, we can identify, I can't. I say we in like the general scientific sense. This is not my own like domain of expertise. But I can at least look at pictures where other scientists have identified and drawn the lines between similar brain structures in each of these creatures. So yesterday we were talking about the desert locust, which is up in the top right. And basically, these kind of central dark green areas are kind of critical areas of processing information for these creatures. And across all of these animals, we can identify common similar structures between all of them. And for some of these creatures, these brains are like 2 millimeters, 3 millimeters wide. They're super tiny. But even so they're very difficult experiments to be able to do, but it's possible in one of these brains to trace the actual connections of individual neurons between these brain regions. And so researchers have done this. So here on the bottom is the desert locust that we were talking about yesterday. It also has this dorsal root on the top. So these kind of big guys out here are the eyes. This area kind of right behind it is the optic tectum. And so researchers have been able to identify the path from the dorsal rim, all the way through the optic tectum, down into kind of critical brain regions to kind of trace the path and see where this information flows in order to, for the animal to merge this information. And one of the interesting things is that, and if we look at this, I mean, so here, you know, one of the key things that is demonstrated in this path is that that path is very similar between honeybee and the bumblebee as it is in the desert locust. And if we look in more depth between the monarch and the desert locust, we can actually see that most of the connections between these critical brain regions are common between these two creatures. So these two creatures have diverged evolutionarily from each other for like millions of years. I can't remember exactly how far it is. I forgot to write it down in my notes. Oh wait, I did write it down in my notes. Sorry, 350 million years. Okay, so 350 million years ago. So for reference, dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. So before dinosaurs even existed, the evolutionary paths of the desert locust and the monarch butterfly diverged. Okay, so they're super far apart, yet all these brain regions that manage the flow of visual information are super similar and are super conserved. Let's see. Any questions, by the way? Yesterday I made sure to like tell people to ask questions while I was chatting.
There's a book about how the regions of fish, ancient fish and us are very similar. Are we at all similar?
Possibly. So ancient fish are at least down the vertebrate chain. You have this kind of first split between vertebrates and invertebrates.
Right.
So it's a little bit that's one of these first splits. And the nervous systems of vertebrates and invertebrates diverge a lot. So when we look at the the brain structures that these guys are working with are quite different. What we do see though is that there are similarities though. For example, the fact that both us and insects kind of have a right side and a left side, and we have kind of a top and a bottom, that's very similar. Octopi don't have that, right? Octopi are constructed differently. The genes and the set of genes that govern the development of our head and the development of insects' heads are actually very similar. And so there are a bunch of genetic similarities. The fact that insects do have brains, whereas like worms don't have brains necessarily, there are similarities. The details of like these structures, we don't have things in our brains that correspond to these structures individually. There are though, I would say, kind of at a slightly more abstract computational level. There are a lot of similarities. So we have in the pattern of as we go through this like raw information that's coming in from the eye that then comes in order to be processed, what we see in a lot of nervous systems is basically a lot of sensors at the edges and at the periphery that are only paying attention to very basic features in the world, and then kind of stages of processing to merge and integrate those features. And so there's kind of abstract commonalities in our brains.
I have a question. If all the information is just to make them go south, how do the ones in New York know to go southwest?
Yeah.
To Mexico and not go to Cuba or something?
I don't know. I have no idea. I think it's a really important point though, because this isn't the whole story,
right?
Okay. Like it's not the whole story, and so I'm sure that there are I'm sure that there are other cues, some of these environmental cues, prevailing winds that are keeping them from just flying, you know, way out into the ocean. If we go all the way back here, like the monarchs that are wintering along the California coast aren't just going dead south, right?
They're going to know milkweed because they're going to grow over the ocean.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at this time in the fall, though, there's no milkweed, right? So they need the cue. They need some cues in the environment to kind of know which way to head. So
they identify strains that go
back. What was that question? I'm sorry.
Are there strains that go to certain geographic areas?
Oh yeah. The question was, are there strains that go to certain geographic areas? I'm not sure. We have another butterfly expert. Do you know if there's strains? Do particular strains of monarchs go to certain areas?
Not that I know of, because I don't know that they have varieties or other species related to them directly.
Okay.
I mean, there are other butterflies in their genus, like the queen and some others, but I'm not sure of their migrations.
I don't think that it's like. My understanding, at least, is that it's not like salmon, you know, where like a salmon will like go back to where it was born and can like sense the particular river. I'm not sure.
Have they done the experiment of grabbing a western?
One of these western ones and like taking it into New Hampshire. Good luck, Maggie. I'm not sure. I don't know.
That would be interesting.
They seem to, when you watch them fly, they seem to fly so slowly and kind of...
Super erratically, I mean, my suspicion is that probably what we're seeing when we see them fly is not in this, like, migratory behavior, right? We're mostly seeing them in the springtime, when they're exploring for milkweed, when they're trying to find, trying to get some nectar.
They're not on the freeway.
Yeah, they're not on the freeway. I think that this fall migration is probably much more of a beeline and is much more of a beeline. That's right. But yeah, the fall migration is probably much more directed, I suspect.
I happen to live right in Texas where those converge, sort of.
Oh yeah.
And I've seen in October 10th is the day I've seen like millions of monarchs as they stay overnight along this creek.
Oh, okay.
And so when they have come in, my experience is along with the northerly wind.
Okay.
And then they'll rest, and then they'll wait for the next northerly push.
To help them move along.
It's amazing. I would love to go to Chihuahua and see them. The real thing.
That's awesome.
So all of this seems to be based around the sun being in the sky. So can neither the monarchs nor any of the other species that you mentioned earlier navigate well at night?
Ah, that's a great question. I've actually got some slides on this. Are you ready for it? So one of these other species, so I had originally planned on a whole lecture on this other species. But realized that I didn't quite have enough information, so I'm glad that, I kept a couple of slides in this talk to be able to discuss. So, this guy. Does anybody know what this is? It's a dung beetle, the dung beetle is an African beetle, and they love poop. And they, in particular, when there is fresh feces, they will dive in, and they need to get in there, and they need to get the poop. They gather up that poop, and they gather up and build a big old ball of poop. And then they need to get back to get out of there, because they're basically competing with all these other dung beetles for this fresh pile of elephant poop or what have you. And so this is a situation where, you know, they go in, they're paying attention to their harvest, they're paying attention to trying to get their poop together. They're fighting with other, they're fighting with other beetles, you know, to be able to get theirs. And so it's really important for them to be able to very quickly get back out to where they came from. And they need to be able to do this day or night, right? And so the really interesting thing with dung beetles is that they take a snapshot of the sky. So they memorize the Milky Way before they go in, and then they rely on that memory of what the sky looks like in order to orient themselves to get out.
Is there problems with light pollution and dung beetle directionality?
I don't know. That's a really good question. Yeah, I don't know.
Do we have dung beetles around?
We don't. No. These are in sub-Saharan Africa. So yeah.
How do you know that the dung beetles do that?
Yeah, no.
They take out their little cameras.
I believe you. I just am curious how you know.
I'm trying to remember the details of the experiment, but. What I recall is that the researchers literally took dung beetles into a planetarium. So they went to because in a planetarium you can control, right? You can simulate the night sky, and you can be in full control of it. And it was a research study where after doing the field work and after doing what manipulations they could out in the field. They brought the beetles into a planetarium in order to test their localization. Because basically what you can do then is you could take that sky and then you can shift it, right?
And like
you
can just push it.
And then see, like, do they navigate based on what? Yeah.
So this effect, they're taking a snapshot of that, and then they're comparing it with the real-time view they have later of the actual sky.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and if we look at some of these other creatures, this kind of like real-time comparison happens a lot. So there's these desert ants that do something very similar, but more looking at features along the horizon. You know, so you've got like trees and hills and such on the horizon as they go out to forage, and what they can do is to get that heading. Is that they like kind of do a template matching of trying to orient to make sure that their heading matches what they remember, and so yeah, so this kind of like so they are able to capture this memory and then use that as a template to reference for their kind of desired behavior. Yeah.
Well, pre-Google Maps, human hunter gatherers really used to do the same thing.
Oh right? Yeah.
Look at the stars, but we have frontal lobes to interpret that for us.
Yeah.
So what is the mechanism that interprets this information for example?
Totally, no, that's a really good question. And so when I say that this central complex is like an area of higher processing, that is kind of the closest comparable to like our frontal lobes. So this is this area that integrates a bunch of information I'm trying to remember the name of the brain structure. I can't remember what it's called though. But it interacts with these memory areas. That really ends up being kind of this like area of central processing.
And then it directs their muscles to move.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Cool. Let's see. So that's all the slides that I have. So as a summary, so monarch butterflies are able to kind of construct an internal sun compass that helps them to be able to navigate. It's not their only cue. There are other things that they need to rely on, but it ends up being at least the compass that they can rely on in order to identify which direction south to go. They rely mostly on a on a combination of sky color and polarization to give them a sense of where the sun is. They combine this information with a clock that tells them what time of day it is that is established through their antennae. And kind of the fundamental circuitry here seems to be shared with locusts and other insects that that have to deal with kind of advanced navigation challenges. So yeah.
Are there any southern hemisphere monarchs that would be flying north? Oh, good question.
That's I don't think so. No, all the monarchs in North America. I don't think there are very many migratory butterflies.
No, even among their own genus, I just looked up the queen, which is the next closest, and it's limited by not being able to withstand cold temperatures. So it lives in like the Midwest to the southern United States, and that's all. So they're unique, even among that.
There must be some butterflies in South America.
Oh yeah, there's plenty of butterflies in South America.
And there may be other migratory ones too, but not to that extent.
Not all are migratory.
So, have they hypothesized why monarchs are migratory and no other butterflies are?
I do not know the answer to that question.
Wouldn't it be their food source? Yeah.
Milkweed? It probably just comes down to milkweed, yeah. If they've found this ecological niche that like locks onto milkweed, and you know, it's basically, it's sort of like, you know, it's sort of chance that they end up having to migrate north just because they're following their food north.
Yeah, unfortunately, milkweeds are considered weeds by most people, and they pull them up. And those of us in the Washington Butterfly Association, anyway, often try to grow them in our yards, actually.
Yeah.
But they're just considered useless to most people, so that's why the populations are declining all the time.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Are they threatened by...
Big time, apparently, now.
Yeah.
The way we operate. So.
Especially in California.
Yeah. There's a really cool kind of forest area in the Bay Area that we went to that
almost every time.
Hosts a lot of.
Actually, they will eat dog bane too, but that's about the only other thing.
They'll eat what?
Dog bane too, to some extent, but it's lesser than milkweed.
Are there any connections to like homing pigeons?
Yeah, I don't know. So this kind of goes back to this question of like, sort of, you know, similarities between humans, vertebrates, and not the mechanistic sense. With homing pigeons and I think, you know, migratory birds more generally, I said that I could talk about the magnetic stuff. So there are lots of birds that have magnetic sense. And this can be confirmed by laboratory studies where you kind of control the magnetic field around them and they can change their orientation. It's down to the point that the conference I went to, because when I was an active researcher, every year there's a big neuroscience conference. And I was studying birds, mostly on vocalization and auditory processing. But I would always hunt out whatever the latest research was on the magnetic sense, because it's an interesting story. And basically, where things sat a few years ago is that there were some researchers that had started to identify the particular brain regions that were sensitive to magnetism, which is a nice step. And they had kind of narrowed down to two possible magnetoreceptors. Either in the eye, there are part of the, and I think this might be similar, I don't know what the whole story is on the antennae, but you know, light is electromagnetism. So there you end up having a lot of commonalities, and especially when you get down to the molecular level, like things can interact in weird ways. So even in our eye receptors, some of the, I don't remember if it's the cones or the rods or what have you, but basically one of the light receptors is magnetic receptive as well. And so that's one candidate for birds. There are also cells in bird, in the pigeon beaks that have like a little bit of iron in them and have the opportunity to be magnetoreceptive. What then, now the challenge then is like, which one are they using? like, can we map the neural connections from the receptor to the brain region? So there's still kind of a lot of open research there to be able to disentangle that. But,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
A couple of semi-related questions. Occasionally you read about somebody trying to mimic this unbelievable behavior in nature for commercial purposes or scientific or military or whatever.
Yeah, totally.
And that's first reason. And secondly, who tends to fund this kind of research?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, obviously it's funded.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Yeah, no, there's a really interesting, a bunch of body of work of like neuromorphic design, which is like, let's try to, design robots, design systems that that are inspired by the behavior of different creatures. Tomorrow we're talking about barn owls and sound localization. This is an area that I'm most familiar with in terms of neuromorphic design, because it ends up being a lot of computation around like orienting based on sound stuff. I think that most of, I don't know who, so as far as kind of like this insect research, a lot of this is funded by NSF, National Science Foundation. DARPA gets into some insect research, I think exactly for these types
DARPA
of things.
Is defense.
Sorry, DARPA is the Defense Agency Research Projects Administration, which is large, which is kind of funded through kind of military stuff. So DARPA gets into more insect research than some other areas. And I think it's kind of because of this, because insect researchers, they have a hard time sometimes justifying their work to the NIH. So the NIH is the biggest funding body of biomedical research. And so as you kind of shift from field research into lab research is almost entirely funded by the NIH. Is the vast majority of the funding. But the NIH, like even when I was, my work was funded through the NIH on European starlings, and that was even kind of weird because it wasn't mice and it wasn't humans. So that was sometimes harder to justify to the NIH. So some of this insect research ends up being coming from DARPA. But yeah, I don't know what the kind of dominant research, funding mechanisms are for this.
Justin, you might mention this book.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Recommended.
Yes. So there's this book that I recommended. It's on the list. It's Super Navigators. It came out a couple of years ago by a great researcher or a great writer, and it's it dives into all kinds of animal navigation stuff and all kinds of very cool research about animals. So You said you've been reading it. And
I have been reading it, but only the last few days. So, but the author is a fellow of the Royal Institute of Navigation in England, and he spent 4 years traveling the world, talking to top researchers in the fields of how creatures navigate.
Yeah.
And it's very accessible. If I can read it, you can read it. So it's really fun, though.
Yeah, awesome. Cool.
Oh, another thing is, if you're out looking for monarchs, there is another butterfly that looks almost exactly like it, which is the viceroy. Monarchs, birds don't like monarchs, and so the viceroy has mimicked the monarch for protection, but they're not a migratory species.
When you were discussing locusts, you mentioned that serotonin might be associated with locusts becoming gregarious.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any neurotransmitters that might be associated with monarch behavior?
Yeah, I'm not sure, honestly. And I think that one of the so this research I got really excited about it a couple of years ago, and one of the it was basically one of the leading, as far as the sun compass stuff with the monarchs and this orienting behavior, it was one of the leading researchers on locusts who had spent decades studying locusts and these neural systems in the locusts, who then turned this attention to the monarchs and basically was able to because so much was similar was able to cover a lot of ground very quickly with the monarchs because of because of the similarities, because they were basically able to be like, all right, like this is what it looks like in the locust, let's check if it works like this in the monarch. So I do think though that this would be then, the field is probably at a nice point though to start to ask some of these questions in the monarchs, kind of building upon the body of work that's known around in the locust too. Yeah.
This is you're describing a really elegant and sophisticated navigation system that you said is 350 million years old. And so from an evolutionary standpoint, I mean, how long did it take to get from amoebas to there? And do you have a sense of what drove that? What,
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know my like long-term history. I mean, like amoebas were, you know, like single-cell organisms were, well, like 4 billion years ago or something like this. You know, so we've got a long time. So there's been plenty of time. As to what drove it, I mean, I think the way that I think about the evolution of these advanced systems is basically that. That you end up with competition in the environment, and any little leg up that you can get on the next guy, you know, gets you a little bit further. And when you stretch that pressure out over millions and hundreds of millions of years, you end up that these little changes can every once in a while, you know, it breaks through and you have something that is utterly transformative. And so I think that the short answer. And it's, yeah. Cool. All right, well, thank you all very much. This has been a great.